Common Ground Radio here on KCNR, downtown Redding, California, where it is a bit smoky. And when we talk about smoke, we all understand that that's a health hazard. It's a dangerous one. Currently, Redding's at 58% particulate level, which is unhealthy. In fact, most of the North State is. And so this is relevant to today's topic, where we're going to have Dr. Chad Hansen, a forestry environmentalist, who specializes in fire, and he'll be talking about that. But that's a health issue that we're all going to be facing for the remainder of the fire season, which hasn't even started officially yet, as well as into the future as climate change is happening, and we can expect more of this. We have hundreds of square miles on fire currently, and what's the future going to look like? The other health issue that is concerning, of course, is the COVID-19 issue. And by the way, folks, COVID-19 is on the increase here in Shasta County, where we already have over 120,000 vaccines given, which is good. We've got about 40% of the population fully vaccinated, which is pretty good, but you know, we need to be at 70% right now. And we've got a current population level of 49.2% with one dose on board, and that once again is going in the right direction. But that's far from where we should be right now. And so all you COVID anti-vaxxers, I want to mention that I've noticed that your leaders, except for Trump, of course, have started asking people to get vaccinated because, you know, they don't want to lose voters. That's what it's coming down to. Most of the people who don't get vaccinated, most of the people, are conservative Republicans who have bought into Trump's Kool-Aid, which is basically, the reason why you're not getting vaccinated is because you don't trust the Biden election. Now, folks, you got to be really drunk on Kool-Aid to get there. That's just phenomenal. Vaccines are available, and I know Doug doesn't Doug denies there's a vaccine for COVID-19. However, the rest of the medical community would call that nonsense. And in fact, that kind of talk is liable, especially upon your constituents. That being said, vaccines are available here in Shasta County all over the place. And you're basically, I'm not going to call you a fool, but you're foolish if you're not getting vaccinated. And if you're not getting, if you're not being responsible to take care of yourself and those that you love around you, you're not an idiot, but you're doing an idiot thing. So, you know, we've really got to start changing the tune, folks. It's just ridiculous. Because we're going to have another spike if you're going to call in today about the COVID situation, don't bother. You know, we won't take your call. Today is basically about the current fire situation within our state forests and with our national forests and private lands as well. That is, basically we're on fire, folks. Northern California is on fire. And this is a situation that is not going away anytime soon. And we've had Dr. Hansen on the air before. Dr. Hansen is a great information source, and he's done a lot of study on fire within our national forest and the state forestry. And there, you know, this is a controversial topic. It's something that we all need to be concerned about. Number one, because it's a health issue. Number two, because it's an economic issue. And number three, because what are we going to do next year at this time if instead of 1,000 square miles, we have 2,000 square miles? When you look at the map, you're wondering, okay, well, this is a huge section, and this is a huge section, so what's going to be left? you know, essentially what's going to be left. And timber is an industry here in California that has been here for an awful long time. And is there a sustainable way to continue that? So with that, RV, how you doing, man?
Great, Christian. How are you today?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm going to let you go ahead and jump in and introduce Dr. Hansen.
Okay, Chris. Every once in a while, living up here in the fire area like we do, and being a journalist, I read books about fire and the forest and stuff, and studies. And every once in a while, something comes along that just blows my mind. And Dr. Chad T. Hansen's new book, Smokescreen, Debunking Wildlife Myths to Save Our Forests and Our Climate, is one of those books. And with that, I'd welcome Dr. Hansen to the show.
Dr. Hansen, you
there?
There he is. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing well. How you doing?
Not too well. My lungs are a little affected. Other than that, I'm kicking. Dr. Hansen, where are you calling from today?
Big Bear City, California, so mountains of Southern California.
Gotcha. And any fire activity your way?
You know, nothing close by. You know, last year we had a fire that was fairly close, so we were under a evacuation advisory, but it never turned into a mandatory. It never got quite that close. This year, so far, nothing real close by.
Well, have you been keeping track of what's going on in our neighborhood with the Taramac lava and salt and sugar and Dixie and, you know, the Beckworth complex? Have you been kind of tracking some of that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I've been tracking all these fires, and I know all these areas quite well. Yeah, I do most of my research in the Sierra Nevada, and my wife and I lived in the northern Sierra Nevada for about 11 years.
Okay. Yeah. And we have talked before, and so forgive me if I don't remember everything from our previous show. But Dr. Hansen, we're on fire, and what alarm would you fire stations will give it a 4, 5, 3 alarm? Where are we at?
Well, I mean, this is a really serious situation because we have a really significant drought year, you know, again, and we've got hot, dry, windy conditions in certain areas, and you're going to get larger fires when you have ignitions, especially when you have unplanned human ignitions, which a lot of these are, and you've got hot, dry, windy conditions and a drought year. I mean, that's that combination that gives you larger fires. And you know, for me, my biggest concern is, the people and the towns in harm's way. And I think that there's not enough focus or attention being placed on that. We really need to just pay attention to what the current science is telling us, which is that the only way to save homes and towns from wildland fire is to focus on the homes and towns. That's where our attention needs to go. That's where our resources need to go. We need to get a handle on these unplanned human ignitions from power lines, from other sources. We need to help communities harden their homes, fireproof homes, do defensible space pruning within 100 feet of homes, evacuation assistance, early warning systems. You know, this is where we need to focus. And also, you know, assistance in terms of community shelters where people are in sensitive groups. You know, shelters with smoke filters. You know, so people can get some relief from that. You know, this is the conversation we need to be having. Instead, most of the conversation is on doubling down on logging out in the forest, and that is not stopping weather-driven fires.
This is RV again, Doc. I noticed yesterday John Garamendi, the District 3 House of Representatives for us, said the same old story that they always say is more thinning is what we need.
Yeah, I mean that's what we're hearing from policymakers, more thinning. And it's not just Republicans and Democrats,
yes.
You know, not all of them certainly, but some are pushing this idea of more thinning. But here's the problem is that these big fires are burning right through thinned areas, oftentimes faster than unthinned forests.
I'll explain that
in a minute.
Fire.
You know, we're seeing that in the Bootleg fire, the 400,000 acre fire in southern Oregon. Vast portions of that landscape that the fire burned through at the most rapid rates were thinned. The fire burned slower through the unmanaged forests in the roadless area and the wilderness area. And despite the fact the forests are very dense and had a lot of dead trees and down logs, fire burns slower through those areas. We're seeing it in fires in California. A lot of these areas that the fires are burning very, very rapidly through were heavily thinned, commercially thinned, in the past, 20, 25 years, sometimes earlier, sometimes than that, and sometimes more recently. But this is not stopping the fires, and oftentimes, again, the fires burn more rapidly through thinned areas because there's not as much of a windbreak effect. Denser forests have a lot more moisture. They have more cooling shade of the forest canopy. They oftentimes have less of the more combustible understory vegetation because there's not as much sunlight reaching the forest floor. So you don't have as much grass and shrubs or small trees oftentimes if you have high canopy cover. And, people think about trees in terms of, they think of trees as fuel. Well, if you're removing trees from forests, maybe you're reducing fuel. That's the assumption. The problem is that it doesn't really work that way. Tree trunks don't really combust, in fires. They can get scorched, but they don't really add to and drive the flames. It's really small diameter material, twigs and pine needles and dry leaves on the forest floor, seedlings and saplings. That's really what drives fires mostly in terms of the vegetation. But the vegetation is so secondary compared to weather and climate. These are really weather and climate driven fires. And, we're just not going to be able to address that with chainsaws and bulldozers.
Yeah, Dr. Hansen, is there a way to thin that you would like to see?
Well, I mean, I think that's the whole approach of thinning is really just not recognizing that this is fundamentally about weather and climate and climate change. And you can certainly do less harm by thinning smaller trees, but you're not going to stop the fires. And that's the thing. We have to just accept that weather and climate are driving these events. And when you have hot, dry, windy conditions, the fires are going to move through those thinned areas, and they often move through faster. So, for example, I just did an analysis of the Creek Fire that burned last year, 380,000 acres in the southern Sierra Nevada. And the thinned areas burned more intensely than the unthinned forests. And those are commercial thins, but even the pre-commercial thin areas burned more intensely than most of the unthinned forests. And so this was, these were areas where they just removed trees up to 8, maybe 10 inches in diameter, very small diameter thinning. Point is that, again, it didn't stop the fires, and it didn't even reduce fire intensity. Now, you're going to get variable effects, right? So it's not like you can't find a thinned area that burns at low intensity. There's plenty of areas like that because fires are variable. But when you look at this at the landscape scale, by and large, the thinned forests are burning at mostly moderate and high intensity oftentimes, especially when you get these hot, dry, windy conditions.
I don't know if you're familiar with the Highway 44 project that started here last year. I wouldn't call it a thinning project. It's more along the lines of what you're talking about, protecting human habitat. From Millville to Shingletown, which is about a 20-mile stretch, they just basically denuded everything 100 feet from both sides of the road. Is that useful?
No, I mean, denuding everything is really not the answer. If you're talking about a key evacuation route, it can be useful to do some pruning on 100 feet on either side of the evacuation route. That's key, obviously. You want to make sure that people can get out safely if they're evacuating. So to the extent that there are evacuation routes involved, that can be helpful. But as a fire break, it doesn't really make sense. People talk about fuel breaks and fire breaks. The problem is that fires are driven by, again, climate and weather, hot, dry, windy conditions, and the embers can be blown by the fires for miles in advance of the flames. They'll go right over a, six-lane highway. They'll go right over, just about anything. They'll go miles. So, yes. There's no fuel break that is effective against embers. And in fact, the fires oftentimes burn faster through the fuel breaks for the reasons I just mentioned.
Right.
I think that the focus needs to be on the homes themselves. It needs to be on making sure that when fires occur, because they will, when they occur, that the homes don't burn and that people get out safely. So I mean, that should be our overriding goal.
If you're, so if that's okay. By overriding, you mean, look, let's forget about the forest right now. Let's forget about trying to mitigate that. Let's focus in on the urban interface. Is that basically what you're saying?
I'm saying let's focus on making sure that you know, as our top priority, making sure that we save homes and lives, but also on preventing human ignitions near communities because, right. You know, without the ignition, the fire doesn't burn, right? You know, fires don't spontaneously, you know, erupt. They have to have an ignition source. And so, you know, we can do something about that. There's a lot of things we can do if we focus on the ignitions. These fires, you know, a lot of these fires wouldn't even be happening without the ignitions. So we need to focus on the ignitions, preventing those. You know, and I'm talking about human ignitions, obviously. We're going to have lightning strikes that'll cause fires. That's natural. It's been going on for millions of years. But we don't want to add to that with all the human ignitions from power lines and from illegal campfires or other things that people are doing to cause ignitions in forests, oftentimes near communities. So we have to prioritize public safety on this. And also recognize, by the way, you know, this is really important, just recognize that fires don't destroy forest ecosystems. They don't. I mean, they create incredibly important habitats. We actually have a deficit of fire relative to historic levels. We're getting much closer to historic levels in recent years, but we don't have an unnatural excess of fire in our forests. You know, last year we had 4 million acres burn in California, and I know that's shocking to a lot of people, and it should be from a human health and safety standpoint because most communities are not protected or defended because we're not spending our resources in the right places. But ecologically speaking, going back millions of years, you know, four million acres in California would have just been an average year before fire suppression. So just we need to keep in mind that fire is not an unnatural destructive force in forest ecosystems. A lot of species depend on post-fire habitat, including areas where fire kills most or all the trees. We call that snag forest habitat, and it's actually comparable to old-growth forest in terms of native biodiversity and wildlife abundance. The forests regenerate naturally like they've been doing for millions of years. But what is destructive, what is catastrophic, is if homes burn, if lives are lost, if people are hurt. And that's what we need to focus on.
Is there a way to ballpark what the percentage of what we're doing now to as far as, you know, you want to do more focus on the homes? Is there a percentage of what we're spending right now? Like, how do we tell if we're prioritizing it or not?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. You know, there's virtually no money going to home protection. I mean, virtually none. There was a legislative proposal last year that would have, you know, reversed that to some extent, but it's not been reintroduced. I can tell you that in the governor's budget, for example, just taking state of California as an example, it's 3% of what he's proposed for wildland fire issues and management issues. Only 3% is allocated for home hardening and defensible space, basically protecting communities. I think that's unconscionable given what we're seeing and given the risks that communities are facing. And the vast majority of the money that's being proposed is for more logging operations, you know, under the rubric of thinning or other terms that we hear. You know, but these are logging operations and they're not stopping fires. And again, in most cases, the fires will burn more rapidly and more intensely through those logged areas. We're seeing the same thing at the federal level right now in terms of legislative proposals. You know, upwards of 80-90% of the funding that's being proposed is for more logging and not for home protection.
Now, I understand that. So, Dr. Hanson, let's do this. Let's wave the magic wand. And let's say that there was a way to keep all human activity out of the forest. There was a way to mitigate the PG&E's actually claiming responsibility for one of the fires up here, and their solution is to bury cable. Well, so back to the magic wand. Let's keep everybody out of the forest, and let's harden the urban interface or protect, you know, people's homes. How long will it take? Because I understand your concept is that over 100, maybe 200 years, that forest will start to take care of itself. Is that kind of what I'm assuming you're saying?
Well, yeah, and I'm not talking about keeping everyone out of the forest. It's the last thing I want. I actually, you know, I think that we want to emphasize recreation. We want to emphasize, you know, the great things that forests do and that really drive a lot of rural economies.
Yeah, but how do you
you know,
do
recreation
that?
Recreation provides a lot more jobs than logging does. You know, so I don't think we need to keep people out of the forest. We just need to do a lot better job of curbing and stopping unplanned human ignitions.
How do you do that?
Most of these forests, take the forest where I live, for example. I'm surrounded on all sides by the San Bernardino National Forest in Southern California. This is one of the most visited forests in the entire country in terms of recreation. A lot of people here, a lot of people doing things, and oftentimes people doing things that they shouldn't be doing. But sometimes they, you know, there's just no one there to keep an eye on it.
So
we only have two law enforcement officers
for
this entire ranger district, you know, and we're talking, you know, hundreds of thousands of acre area. There's two law enforcement officers for this ranger district.
How many officers would we need?
Well, and it doesn't need to all be law enforcement either. We just need more rangers out there, boots on the ground.
Exactly.
We need to probably increase it by, you know, tenfold relative to what we have now. But right now, there's just very few. It's a pittance because most of the money is going to logging crews, and that's just not where we need to go in the future.
So let's go back to the magic wand. If you can wave your magic wand, you know, what are the solutions that we need to be? I understand we need, you're saying funnel money out of timber operation. I understand that. And funnel some money out of fire operation. I understand that. And funnel it into hardening, homes and protecting lives. But how that's done? Somebody like me who's not an ecologist or average citizen here in Redding, California would go, okay. So how do we do that? I mean, knowing human behavior, you know, look at the COVID as an excellent example of human behavior. Look at climate change as an excellent example of human behavior. So I don't want to become a nihilist and go, well, there's nothing we can do about that. So, Dr. Hansen, yeah, in your book, do you have some hard solutions? In other words, this forest district needs 3,000 more rangers. And they need to do what? This district needs hardening. And what I'm getting at is what's your goals and what's your solutions? I understand the goals a little bit, but we need some solutions.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And that's what we need to be talking about. I do talk about that in great detail in my book, Smokescreen, debunking wildfire myths to save our forests and our climate. You know, I talk about this a lot. I have a whole chapter devoted to those solutions, and I talk about it quite a bit in the other chapters as well. And it really comes down to this. You know, it's about changing direction. I realize this is not going to happen, you know, immediately or overnight. It's not like you snapped your fingers and this all happens. You know, I live in the real world as we all do. But we need to start pushing for change, and we need to start holding policymakers accountable, state and federal level, Democrats and Republicans. We need to hold everyone accountable to start doing the right things and stop basically just doing business as usual, because business as usual is not working. It is literally burning towns down. It's getting people killed. We have to change direction, and it's making climate change worse, and we can't afford that either, right? What we need to do is redirect the funds, the billions and billions of dollars we're spending every year, redirect that money away from logging and backcountry fire suppression and into a few key things. Number one, a jobs program to help homeowners harden their homes and do defensible space. Some people need the assistance, the technical assistance. Some people need the physical assistance. Some people need the financial assistance. And I think we should be providing that. People need the help. And this is a key role that the Forest Service can play, because there's a lot of people living adjacent to national forest lands and BLM lands. So that's one. And there's a lot of jobs in that. And they're good jobs. Good jobs saving people's, you know, lives and homes. And number two, we need a lot more boots on the ground. We need a lot more rangers, like I said. You know, we need to really, you know, staff that up significantly, including, you know, really focused on preventing unplanned human ignitions, particularly near towns, particularly during hot, dry, windy conditions in fire season. That needs to be a priority. That's not even part of the conversation right now, which to me is just nuts.
And it might be that because the people aren't bringing it into the conversation enough. And yeah, that's your ballpark. That's your expertise, and I understand that. But what, that stuff needs to get out in like a real simple. These are the 10 things that need to be done and need to be done now. So when you go to a policymaker or you go to a politician, you can say, this is my blueprint. This is my platform.
I agree. I mean, and that's what we're doing that every day, and many others are too. We just need a lot more additional people to join that, and not just sort of think, well, you know what, people are working on this and they've got it covered. People need to get involved because we're going to keep seeing these impacts to communities. Again, the fires aren't destroying the forest. That's not where our worry should be. But fires do and can destroy towns, and we're seeing significant loss of lives in a number of these fires. And the tragedy is that it's almost entirely preventable if we focus our resources in the right places. And by the way, you mentioned fire suppression a minute ago, and I mentioned as well, we need to get away from backcountry fire suppression, because of course, once fires are driven by wind, hot, dry, windy conditions, they're not going to stop until the weather changes. We don't stop fires with fire suppression. The only times we really stop them is when the weather is really, really calm and it's kind of cool and moist and there's a lightning ignition and, the fire's barely moving. You could really put it out with your boots if you wanted to. Those are easy to put out. But once you've got the even moderately hot, dry, windy conditions, the fire's moving, it's driven by weather, it's going to be stopped by weather and weather only. But there is something that fire suppression can do, which is preventing towns from burning. I've seen very successful activities where fire suppression forces are laying down lines of water drops right at the boundary of the property line, doing last-minute defensible space work, helping people and their animals safely evacuate.
Excuse me for a minute, Doc.
There's a number of things that I've seen be very successful at the boundary of communities.
Dr. Hansen, we have to pay the bills. Excuse us for a minute while we take a commercial break.
We'll be right back. Hold that thought, Dr. Hansen, that we're on to some solutions. So I really appreciate that. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
I expected to be a lot easier.
I didn't know what step to take next.
I was transitioning from the military. I was a vehicle gunner.
An avionics specialist.
I missed my unit, my family.
Playing with my daughter, I'd felt like a stranger.
I didn't have a clear sense of what to do next.
And then I thought, if I'm going through this, other veterans have gone through it too, right?
So I reached out, and I saw that I wasn't alone.
Go to maketheconnection.net to learn how other veterans have overcome the challenges of transitioning out of the military.
These are unprecedented times. Challenging how the YMCA works to strengthen community as we have for nearly 170 years. But we've always found ways to help people and communities in times of crisis. Right now, Ys across the country are providing emergency child care, shelter, food programs, and outreach to seniors. But we can't do it alone. Whether you're connected to the Y or have a fond Y memory, we need you to stay with us. Reach out to your local Y today and stay with us for a better us.
Hi, I'm Arielle Winter. If you're anything like me, your pets are not only your best friends, they're part of your family. American Humane, which has been rescuing animals like Cleo here for more than 100 years, has life-saving tips that can make a big difference in a disaster. When disaster strikes, you want to protect your whole family, including your pets. To help keep your family safe and help our best friends in their worst times, find tips at AmericanHumane.org.
I expected it to be a lot easier.
I didn't know what step to take next.
I was transitioning from the military. I was a vehicle gunner.
An avionics specialist.
I missed my unit, my family.
Playing with my daughter, I'd felt like a stranger.
I didn't have a clear sense of what to do next.
And then I thought, if I'm going through this, other veterans have gone through it too, right?
So I reached out, and I saw that I wasn't alone.
Go to maketheconnection.net to learn how other veterans have overcome the challenges of transitioning out of the military.
And we're back with Dr. Hansen, forest ecologist, specialist in forest and fire. And Dr. Hansen, before we go any further, how do we get your book? How do we buy your book? And how do we get a hold of you if people have questions?
Yeah, great question. So you can get my book Smokescreen on Amazon. You can get it on bookshop.com. Again, just Google the title of Smokescreen, Debunking Wildfire Myths to Save Our Forests and Our Climate. Amazon and bookshop.com are the main two places to get it. And as far as contacting us, you can go on the John Muir Project website, www.johnmuirproject.org, and our contact information is there. And lots of information. We have lots of information on the website, and including studies and fact sheets and things that action alerts that people can download. But also our contact info is on there. So if people want studies or more information, we're happy to provide that.
Great book. I've perused it, and great website. This is a valuable resource, folks. RV.
Doc. I wanted to say what sort of one of my beliefs about the fire situation before I read your book. And I wanted to see if you think this is a myth or not. Before I read your book, the story I've been told was that 100 years or so of fire suppression has supposedly led to overgrown forests that now need trimming. Is there more to the story than that? Is that even true?
There's a lot more to the story, and it's certainly true that we've been suppressing fires for 100 years. It's not true that forests that haven't burned in a long time will burn more intensely. And I know that seems counterintuitive, and I have, I have a lot of information in the book about this, and yes. Of course I have hundreds of scientific studies cited in the endnotes. But, I wrote the book for non-scientists, so it's accessible to non-scientists. I wrote a textbook on this issue in 2015, and that was really for, scientists in university classrooms. But I wrote this one specifically for the general public because we need to broaden the message. We need, to get it out there. And this is one of the most persistent myths out there, this idea that because we've been suppressing fires for 100 years, we can't just let a lightning strike in a remote forest burn, to restore fire to those areas, because if a forest hasn't burned in 80 or 100 years, it's too dense, it's overgrown, and because of fuel accumulation, it's going to burn mostly at high intensity, uncharacteristically severe wildfire. That's the narrative. That's what we hear. We have studied this issue to death, and we keep finding the same thing. I've published two studies on this. I've got another study that's in review right now. We're all finding the same thing. The forests that haven't burned in over a century, they burn mostly at low and moderate intensity when fires occur. They don't tend to burn more intensely than other forests. In fact, they often burn less intensely. Denser forests often burn less intensely than more open forests. And by the way, the whole notion that our forests are overgrown, we actually have less carbon in most of our forests, less biomass, less carbon than we did historically, 150 years ago. And for the simple reason, we've been pulling massive amounts of carbon out every single year for more than a century through logging operations. And so it's really kind of misleading, this whole overgrown forest narrative myth, that this notion, because it gives people this sense that there's just too much wood in our forests. And that's actually not true. The areas that are burning most rapidly and most intensely tend to be the areas that have been logged and where a lot of trees have been removed. And the reason is just, it comes down to microclimate. A dense forest has, and including forests that haven't burned in over a century, which tend to be denser,
right,
they have more canopy cover because they have more trees, they have more biomass. More canopy cover means more cooling shade of the canopy cover. It means you have a moister, cooler, shadier microclimate. Less sunlight reaching the forest floor, which means a lot of the grasses and the shrubs and the small trees die back. A lot of the, understory vegetation that can most easily carry flames, that starts to die back because it's not getting as much sunlight as it needs. Lower limbs on the mature trees start to self-prune, and the crown, kind of goes higher above the ground. Denser forests act as a windbreak against the winds that drive flames.
That would seem to be the most
important.
But
when logging occurs, like thinning, you get hotter, drier, windier conditions because it reduces the canopy cover and it spreads combustible invasive grasses like cheatgrass.
Do we have a caller on the line, Randy? Hello, Randy.
Hello, good morning.
Randy, you're talking to Dr. Hansen.
Hello, Dr. Hansen. Hey, I've done my own studies on all the situation. I'm in Northern California, And I just want to run my perspective by you to see if I have any of it right or wrong. Anyway, the way I'm looking at this in the long picture is looking way down the future, like hundreds of years into the future. And at this point in our planet, the driving force of our planet is diversity. The biodiversity of our planet is the strength of life on Earth, and it's being ravaged by human activities. And that threat is coming in the form of climate change, deforestation, and general abuse. And so to recover from that, from the point where we're at now, like if I look at it, I see all the equipment they use to deforest. If that was used to generally maintain and get forests back to a point to where they could regenerate on their own and use that equipment to protect civilizations, you know, that would be a step going in the right direction. The key issue here is the ecological integrity of what we have left to maintain that. Anyway, do I have any of that right? Thank you.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, look, the loss of biodiversity and the impacts to wild places in this country and across the world is one of the key threats, you know, to life on Earth, including human life. The United Nations just released a report earlier this year, a landmark historic report called Making Peace with Nature. And they flagged the loss of biodiversity and loss of wild places and degradation of wild places as one of the key threats to humanity, along with pollution and, of course, the climate crisis. You know, so, yeah, we absolutely, you know, need to rethink the way our relationship with nature, in a sense. You know, we need to rethink a lot of the things we're doing, and we need to focus on, you know, you're absolutely right. We need to focus a lot of our machinery, our equipment, our resources on helping communities become safe and be more resilient to, you know, the changes that we're seeing. As far as forests go, you know, they don't really need our help to regenerate. You know, fire has been going on in forests for over 350 million years on this planet. This is deep evolutionary history. They regenerate wonderfully after fires, including, you know, big high-intensity fire patches. They still regenerate. Doesn't matter how far it is away from the nearest live tree. I just published a study on this earlier this year in the biggest high-intensity fire patches in the Rim Fire that, you know, hadn't been logged or planted or anything. And, you know, it's just amazing. You know, even more than 1,000 feet away from the nearest live trees, hundreds of naturally regenerating conifer seedlings and saplings per acre, you know, now.
Well, one of the most things in your book about the Rim Fire, the Rim Fire that was interesting, is that scene that you just described was not in the reports of the people that were visiting there previously, correct?
Right. I mean,
they were trying to cover up the fact that the forest recovers.
Exactly. So the Forest Service was telling, and still actually is telling the public, that these larger high-intensity fire patches have no regeneration. They say no regeneration, and in some places they say little or no conifer regeneration. But that was based upon data they gathered in 2014 and 2015, just 1 and 2 years post-fire. And, you know, it's true that in just 1 and 2 years post-fire, some of those areas didn't have much, and some didn't have any. But the problem is people come into a fire area, especially a high-intensity fire patch, you know, where the fire killed most or all the trees. They come in at 1 year post-fire, and they think that's all that – whatever regeneration you have at 1 year is the only regeneration you're ever going to have. And it doesn't work that way. You get more every year. I know some areas that had almost no regeneration at 3 or 4 years post-fire, and by 6 years post-fire, there were 300 pine and fir saplings per acre, mostly pine.
Dr. Hansen, theoretically, let's take a high-intensity area. How many years does it take to kind of get back to something, a semblance of what it was, let's assuming a natural state?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, this is something I emphasize in the Smokescreen book, especially in Chapter 2, which is all about, you know, what I call snag forest habitat, and that's those areas of mature forest that do burn at high intensity and where most or all the trees are killed. And it's incredibly rich in biodiverse habitat. And I guess what I sort of counsel people to think about is accepting the importance of that stage of things, and not just thinking, well, you know, how long will it take for it to become a mature forest again? But, you know, in direct answer to your question, you know, to become a mature forest, You know, it can take you know, 60 or 70 years to develop that structure. Of course, you know, it takes longer for the trees to get even larger. But I can tell you that in the largest high intensity fire patches in the rim fire, for example, in the interior of those patches, farthest away from live trees, right now, at just 8 years post-fire, when I'm doing field work in there, what I'm seeing are trees that are, in many cases, especially the pines, 14 feet tall already and 3 or 4 inches in diameter in many cases. And so just, you know, that trajectory is pretty remarkable. I mean, these trees, a lot of them are going to be over 30 feet tall in another decade, and they're going to be, you know, 7, 8 inches in diameter, some of them, at the rate they're growing.
In your book, you talk a lot about the benefit of down trees. And I wanted to, like, I guess about 2 or 3 years ago, they were talking about the tree deaths, especially in the Southern Sierra, from bark beetles, and 150 million dead trees that supposedly have to be incinerated or taken out. I would imagine that you would have a different opinion about that.
I do, yeah. I mean, some of that's really been misreported. So the figure about the dead trees, unfortunately, you have to take the total figure a little bit with a grain of salt, because they're flying over the same areas again and again, and so they're double counting and triple counting a lot of those trees. Having said that, you know, it definitely, between 2012 and 2017, it was a really significant period of what I call snag recruitment. You know, you've got drought conditions, and you have a lot of forests that had very, very few snags and down logs before that now have a nice abundance of them, and that's a good thing for biodiversity. What's interesting is that the assumption was, if you have a lot of dead trees in a forest and you have a lot of down logs, the forest is going to burn much more intensely. People think about it that way. In reality, it doesn't work that way, and this issue has been studied extensively too. The largest and most comprehensive studies, including one that I'm just finished and is in review right now, and another one I published years ago, what they find is that forests with more dead trees and down logs do not burn more intensely. They often burn less intensely. Dead trees, and especially down logs, you know, they act like large moisture reservoirs, like large reservoirs of water. They soak up and retain soil moisture. Like
the sponges, plants. You call them in the book.
Say again?
Sponges.
Yeah, they act like big sponges. So certainly, you know, they're going to get scorched in a fire. They can get partially consumed if they're really, really old and they're really kind of broken up into hundreds of little pieces. You know, that can completely smolder, you know, long after the flames have passed and turn into a little bed of ash. You know, you'll see that sometimes. But it's not like I talk to people and they say, well, what about these dead trees? You know, they're just exploding in the forest. And that's just mythology. Trees don't explode. Live trees don't explode and dead trees don't explode. The fire passes over them, it chars a certain portion, and it keeps moving. But the thing is that it's just like building a campfire. You know, you don't put a big log on a fire and put a match to it and expect it to burn. That is absolutely not going to happen. You'll burn your fingers. And you need kindling. And it's the same thing at a forest fire. Large logs, big snags, there's not much to carry flames because the twigs and the needles and the, you know, small branches, that stuff has already fallen down and decayed into the forest floor, and you just don't have much to drive flames. So they'll get scorched, but they don't contribute to fire intensity in any significant way.
I wanted to talk about our current state senator, Brian Dolly, when he was an assemblyman. We're going back to the rim fire here again, and you wrote about this in the book as well. He wrote a opinion column about the massive loss of carbon from the rim fire, and I believe he compared it to the annual amount of auto emissions in California. And of course, you address in your book why that's incorrect. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, of course. I mean, this is a really important question, and I've got a whole chapter on this. You know, people made these assumptions about carbon emissions from forest fires, and they oftentimes would use really hyperbolic terms like, you know, carbon bomb. And it turns out, you know, that we have a whole series of models that we've been using at state and federal levels and all over the world to try to estimate the amount of carbon that's consumed in a fire, the amount of vegetation that's actually consumed and therefore emitted into the atmosphere. The problem is that none of those models were actually based on field data. They were just based on what people kind of assumed and made sense to them.
Wow.
And this went on for years and years, and it still goes on every single year. Every fire season, we see these reports. You know, it's equivalent to X number of cars and things like that. The problem is that none of the models have been effectively recalibrated based upon the field data. And what the field data are telling us, and I'm doing a study on this right now, but many others have been published, is that only about 1 or 2% of the carbon in trees is actually consumed, even in a big forest fire. 1 or 2%. About 3% in a crown fire, and it's just a small fraction of 1% in low intensity and a fraction of 1% in moderate. It averages out to, you know, around 1%. Sometimes it can be as much as 2%. Sometimes it's just a fraction of 1%. And we're talking not just small fires. We're talking in big, you know, big fires.
And these numbers that people are putting out.
Component of moderate and high intensity.
The numbers that
and
people
so
have been
far
using.
Far less of the tree biomass, the above ground right. biomass, is actually being consumed in fires. Far less is being consumed than we used to think or assume. Yet the models haven't been updated and calibrated to catch up with current science. The other thing that the models fail on is that they all effectively assume that nothing regrows after a fire. In other words, none of the models take into account post-fire regrowth and therefore carbon absorption from the atmosphere, because everything that grows after a fire is pulling CO2 out of the atmosphere and basically sequestering and storing that in the growing shrubs and trees and the wood that's growing in the forest. And that growth is fairly rapid and dramatic, and it accelerates with every year post-fire. And it's very heterogeneous. In some places it takes off quicker, in some places it takes a few years. But, you know, the conifers and the oaks and the shrubs, they sequester and store a huge amount of carbon. And basically the carbon that's emitted is recouped fairly quickly in a forest if it's not logged.
You know, Dr. Hansen, I'm going to be seeing a person this afternoon who is running for Doug LaMoffa's seat here in California. And, you know, and this individual has advocated that we do need to harvest after a fire, do so sustainably, and we do need government money for inputs to reforest in the proper way, in a natural ecological way. And so, you know, politicians are using and they should, because that's part of their mandate, is protect the people and protect the environment and protect the, you know, the economy and so forth. So we're going to see an increased, you know, politician input on this whole thing. What three things would you advise Max Steiner, who is running against Doug LaMoffa, to consider?
Okay, thanks. Yeah, so three things I would say. Number one, the overwhelming majority of scientists have told agencies and Congress that post-fire logging and artificial tree planting is one of the most destructive and unnecessary things you can do in forest ecosystems, number one. And we've sent letters to Congress, hundreds of us, on this. Number two, you know, the science is increasingly telling us that you don't need to plant trees after fires. They naturally regenerate. If an area burns in a fire and it burns again, it doesn't all burn at high intensity. It burns at a mix, just like other forests do. Oftentimes they burn mostly at low and moderate intensity, so there's always a component of high intensity if an area that you know that burns in a fire reburns. But the idea that all the dead trees and down logs are just going to, you know, drive the flames, you know, much more intensely, it doesn't work that way for the reasons I mentioned earlier. And the interesting thing is, and this would be number three, is that, and this is interesting and alarming, but where post-fire logging and tree plantation establishment has occurred, those areas tend to burn more intensely most of the time when a subsequent wildfire occurs. So you're not curbing fires, you're not reducing fuels, you're not, you know, certainly not saving towns by doing that, and you're not helping the forest recover. Many of these areas, and if I could add a number four, I would add this, many of the areas that are post-fire logged and planted end up basically being converted to invasive grassland and bare ground. because the planted trees grown in these nurseries are not adapted to those microsites. And in many cases, most of the planted trees die. There's so much soil damage done by the logging machinery, so much nutrients are removed, I can take you to numerous places, like in the Rim Fire, for example, but many other fires as well, where you've got the snag forest habitat that was not planted, not logged, where you've got this, you know, wonderful, vigorous conifer forest regeneration naturally occurring, and right next to it you have a post-fire logging unit where it was logged and planted after the fire, and it's basically just bare ground and a few scraggly, you know, trees that they planted that survived, but most have died. Really, post-fire logging is leading to widespread deforestation.
Understood. If I was to add a number five, would it be, as a politician and a job creator and a protection, responsibility, would it be put the resources into urban interface and work your way out? The concept in your book is you start from the center and work your way out instead of going from the out, working towards the center. And would that be a responsible way for a politician, if you would, to start doing things right in that regard?
Yes, thank you. And I would definitely agree with you, and I would add that as a number five. In fact, I might even make that number one. It's so key, you know, because we're spending millions and millions of dollars, hundreds of millions, billions in many cases, depending on the activity, on these actions, and they're not helping protect homes, they're not protecting lives. If we redirected those funds directly to protect homes and communities, we can save homes and lives. We're seeing numerous examples, and I talk about many of them in my book, Smokescreen, where, you know, these activities were done, home hardening, the defensible space, you know, the focus was put on communities, and a fire occurs, and you've got 99% home survival, in some cases even 100% home survival, and everyone gets out safely. You know, we have numerous success stories, so we know we can do this right. We're just not spending the resources in the right places. So, yeah, I mean, the last thing we need is more post-fire logging and tree plantations. That is not the answer.
Dr. Hansen, we have scientists like you on one side and what seems like many more scientists on the timber industry payroll who are paid very well to tell a story. How much of an obstacle does this present to finding a way forward?
Well, it's definitely an obstacle. And actually the scientists who are independent and who are not paid by the Forest Service or the logging industry directly, the independent scientists actually greatly outnumber the scientists who are paid by the industry or the Forest Service. However, though the scientists who are paid by the Forest Service and the industry are intersecting with the media on a pretty continual and constant basis, and they have a lot of assistance and a lot of funding and resources. You know, so like the Forest Service's public affairs, you know, department is setting up interviews and press interviews, you know, and so they have a disproportionately large voice in the public dialogue. And that's a real problem from a public policy standpoint, because politicians and the general public, you know, they're getting these messages and they're not realizing that it represents a small fraction of the scientists out there. And that the voices that they're hearing are mostly voices who are essentially whose funding is tied to logging.
In the beginning of your book, you talk about Congress passing the Salvage Logging Rider in 1995 and how that changed the course of your career from being an environmental attorney to becoming an ecologist. Could you talk a little bit about that and what the Salvage Logging Rider was and why it alarmed you so much?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, so back in the 1980s and even into the early 1990s, the message from the logging industry, from the Forest Service, and from politicians, you know, who were aligned with the logging industry was just, look, the big trees are out there, we want them, we make money from them, and that's all there is to it. But that began to change by the early 1990s. And the public began to kind of wake up to the fact of what was happening on national forests with taxpayer money, just massive landscapes just being completely clear-cut, old-growth forests being just decimated and destroyed and clear-cut and replaced with tree plantations. And people started turning against that, and the public opinion started turning against the logging program on national forests. And people say, hey, we want our national forests protected. Why are we doing a timber sales program on our national forests? We shouldn't be doing that. And so the message changed. The Forest Service and the logging industry, you know, they stopped even using the word logging. They didn't even use the word timber sale. By the mid-90s, everything was fuel reduction, forest health, restoration.
We've got about 30 seconds left, Doc.
In the 1980s, logging, you know, mature trees, logging old growth trees, clear cutting, post-fire clear cutting. But, you know, and that's continued to this day.
So
the salvage logging rider in 1995 was the first time that that was really weaponized in a political sense.
We need to, Dr. Hansen, we're at the end of the show. Everybody needs to pick up your book, widely available.